book was called Right View, and then I was quite impressed by Sabana's title. And so I renamed it The Monkey and the Moon. But this is a talk about right view. And right view is one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path. And in a traditional sense, the Buddha taught that right view is seeing a few different things. One is seeing that wholesome actions lead to happiness and away from suffering. He also taught, and this is most often what he taught, and that's what we're going to focus on a lot tonight, is that wise view or right view is seeing the Four Noble Truths for what they are. And also that we see into this the dependence of everything on everything else, that we are not, that life is not static, that things are, as I think Sabana said, kind of a river of experience, and everything is kind of depending on everything else. And so because we're going to talk about that, I thought it would be best if I give you an overview of the Buddha's first teaching for those that haven't heard it, or just because it's wonderful to hear. But in the interest of time, I'm going to refrain from talking about the Buddha's life, which I love doing. But let's just say the Buddha was a wonderful man. And he awakened under the Bodhi tree, right? He was a human man, absolutely wanting, having this longing to understand suffering. And so he sat under the Bodhi tree and he said, I will not get up until I understand the causes of aging, illness, death, the suffering of being human. And he did awaken that night and he came to understand some deep truth. And he decided after some deliberation that he would go and teach this. But he realized that this would be really hard to understand. And so he thought, you know, who can I teach? And he thought of his old masters, but they had passed away. So he decided to go and teach his five mendicants or disciples that had been following him around as he was living the life of an ascetic. And he went to them and he gave this teaching called the turning of the wheel of the truth. And in this teaching was three main parts: the middle way, the Four Noble Truths, and the Eightfold Path. And the middle way for tonight, we'll just kind of skip that, but to say that when they asked him what the middle way was, he told them it was to live the Eightfold Path. Yeah. And that Eightfold Path, I'm just going to go through them now, but we'll come back to it more fully in a moment, was right view, right thought or right intention. That's the same one. Right speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And then he went on to talk about the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth is, as Sabana mentioned or gave a whole talk on, the first noble truth is that there is dukkha. There is dukkha. Often we say that that is suffering, but you could also say it's that inherent dissatisfaction in life, things not being quite right. You know, you meet a man, he's really great, and 3 months later you're kind of like, right? Just things that just, it's never quite right. Or it doesn't last. This is the inherent kind of suffering in life, not to mention the big ones: aging, illness, death, being separated from everything we love. No certainty anywhere we look, right? So that's the first noble truth. There's suffering. It's pretty bleak. If we leave it there. The second is that there is a cause. There is a cause to this dukkha. And that cause is, you know how we experience things as pleasant and unpleasant, and then we want the pleasant and we don't want the unpleasant. So there's this pull of clinging and aversion. And all in all of that, we're kind of, there's like this self that's like wanting everything to be lovely and not wanting things to be bad. And that whole package is the cause of our suffering. It's like I lived in North America for 15 years, so I love this analogy. It's like we are beavers, and there's this life flowing like a river. There's all this phenomena arising and passing and arising and passing. And instead of, you know, instead of kind of just being in the river, we're trying to be on the shore. We're trying to be on a stable place. So we end up being like beavers, and we're trying to dam up a safe space with all the things we like, and we're chucking out the things we don't like, and we're trying to get it all so safe and cozy. And inevitably we forget that we're living in a river and it can all be blown away at any time. And in amongst all of that dam building, we become little self-obsessed beavers. It's just, as Alan said, that self-obsession, that's the cause of our suffering. Yeah. And thank goodness, the third noble truth is that there is an end. And that end, which is the fourth noble truth, is that the Eightfold Path is the way toward happiness and away from this dukkha. So most often right view is considered or presented as the first on the Eightfold Path. And I like it presented this way because it infers that if our view is sound or wise, then the rest flows quite naturally from that. So if we are understanding things correctly, then our thoughts and intention is kind of more on track. And that naturally leads to the morality component, the speech, the action, the livelihood being a little more on track, yeah? And then when there's good morality, when we come to sit and meditate, like, have you ever tried to meditate after you just went and beat someone with a baseball bat or lied profusely? Or it would be pretty challenging, right, to sit there and be with yourself under those conditions. So this kind of strong moral and ethical conduct allows us to sit with what the Buddha calls the bliss of blamelessness, like no regret. There's less to obsess over and forgive and bring compassion to. And then so then our mindfulness is more easeful, our concentration develops more easily. But you could also say that right view is at the end. It's at the end of the Eightfold Path, because if you decided to live a life with a little more morality, then your mindfulness would become more solid, your concentration more solid, and then you would be able to see more clearly into yourself and into what is happening, and therefore the view would become refined. And this is what I deeply love about most of the Buddha's teachings, is they fold back on themselves. Like, it's a cycle. The more we refine our view, the easier it is to meditate. The more we meditate, the more our view is refined, and around it goes. Worth saying that I'm noticing that I'm using the word right sometimes, and then sometimes wise, and then sometimes sound. So the Pali word is sama, and sama most closely translates to the English word right, but it's not in the sense of right or wrong. I heard a teacher once say it's like if someone came and asked you for directions and you gave them the ones that took them the right way. It's that kind of right. It's going to take you where you're looking to go. So it's not like you're good if you have this view and you're bad if you don't. It's this is the view that's going to take you to happiness and lead you away from suffering. So you can also, if you like the words wise or sound, you could use those when I say right. And the word ditti, so samaditti is right view. The word ditti is translated as view, belief, opinion, theory, doctrine. So it's what we're believing to be true and definite in any one given moment. And so the words together, samaditti, is right philosophy, right view, or seeing things in the correct or most helpful way. We're going to look at some contemporary ideas about right view, and then we'll go into the more traditional views of right view, views of view. So if we take a look around right now, we can see, and Anzac Day is a wonderful example of, there's not a lot of beautiful, loving, kind views in our world. Yeah, I mean, there is a lot, but there's a lot of wrong view too. We can see that quite naturally. And war is only possible because one side believes something to be definite, and so does the other, right? This is why it's even possible to go to war. People believe this is how it is, and that's it. And it might be that they're willing to, you know, people, all of us, we're willing to say, oh, no, I can have my mind changed about all of these things, but not that thing or that thing, right? There's just those things where we're like, no, 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 this is just how it is, right? So have you guys heard of George Miller? George Miller? No. So George Miller was one of the founders of cognitive psychology, and he was the author of the 1956 paper, The Magical Number 7 Plus or Minus 2. So what he's saying is that each experience we have is data rich, that actually in any one given moment of attention, there are 2 billion bits of data coming to us. In any one movement, 2 billion bits of data, yet we process, can you guess? 7 plus or minus 2. Mull that over. So what are we doing? In any one of those moments where 2 billion bits of data are coming in, we are in a process of deleting whatever doesn't already fit with our view. So we're deleting, we're distorting what is really out there to create a picture of the life that, as we see it, our perception of life. There's this flow, this river of life, and then we're just taking out 7 plus or minus 2, right? So one could say there is no inherent real experience. There is just each person's subjective experience. When I was writing this, I was like, well, how do we choose this data? How do we do that? How do we choose which 7? I think, you know, it's like what we pick out is colored by our past experiences. So how we were raised, what we were told, what we already believe, the voices of our parents, our society, all informs kind of this basis of how we see the world, what we think is real. And we're not really going to pick up any data that doesn't match that existing image. Maybe like a little bit on the outside, but nothing drastically different. So we're continuing to see the world based on our past conditions, continuing to see the world on our existing ideas of what is right and wrong, and on our existing ideas on what we believe to be true. So in other words, on our existing views. And essentially, our views, our opinions, our beliefs, what we think is right and wrong, is what gives us a sense of place. But this is how we know who we are. So without the views, there's not as much of a sense of self, and that can be really scary. So we're gathering the data and we're creating views so that we know, like, oh, this is who I am. I belong with this group of people who believe this thing. And I know who I am because I believe that. And we see this evidence all over the world as people find their place in gangs, neo-Nazi groups, conspiracy theorists. Yeah, this is how people get their sense of place. And as we heard last night, it's really scary to be alone. And we want to fit in. I became a paramedic when I was in my early 20s, and I worked in the ghettos of Central California in a town called Stockton, which had one of the highest murder rates per capita in the whole country. This question of why people believe what they believe has been alive in me since then. Going into these gang areas, like over here in the town is a black gang and over here is a Hmong gang and over here is the black gangs and over here is kind of the poverty-stricken white people, and they all have these different ways that they live. And then the next town over is wealthy and they have a totally different view. It became really obvious to me. We're only really believing just this, what everyone else is. We're so influenced by what's around us, yeah? And later when I was a firefighter paramedic in Sacramento, I went on a drive-by shooting. I'm not going to tell you any gory details, but I went on a drive-by shooting, which, to be honest, was so common there. Those kinds of things don't even make the news, yeah? It's like a dime a dozen. The drive-by shooting, this Mexican family was having a party in their backyard or through the whole house, and a van of an opposite gang came past and just opened fire. And actually, no one was killed. But we arrived and I took two men in my ambulance. When things like that happen, often you take sort of someone with a minor injury and then someone with a severe injury. So I took a one man with a gunshot in his leg and another with two in his chest. But they were out to the side, so they hadn't hit anything vital, it didn't seem. And so this man was rather jovial. And he was so lovely and so polite, as I had often experienced gang members to be. And we chatted on the way to the hospital. And he was just really lovely. Like, I quite liked him. We'd chat this, oh, thank you, ma'am, or no, ma'am, or yes, ma'am, you know. And about halfway there, because I was thinking of him as kind of this victim. And about halfway there, he said, oh, ma'am, would you mind answering your question? I was, oh, yeah, sure, anything, sir. And he said, do you know if anyone managed to shoot back? And I was like, oh, right. This is a gangbanger. That's the term there, yeah? This is a man whose life is... This is not unusual for him, yeah? And it's like, you know, the media often portrays these people as really evil people, but it's not the case. This is a lovely man in this family that I'm guessing probably had really great family values. Like, this is the kind of guy you'd want on your side. I bet he would be a really loyal friend. He would totally take care of you. I bet he loves his children. He's probably a fantastic dad, right? But what is the view of these people in this gang? They believe that loyalty is the most important thing. They believe that fighting for your family, retribution, is the right and just thing, and that to be a man is to stand up for what you believe in, right? So it's not the action that's the problem, the shooting people, it's the view. These people believe above all else that you must defend to your death your family and your friends. Taking time to contemplate why we believe what we believe is really valiant work. If we look deeply, we might see that our views are often the ideas and viewpoints of others, that they are not inherently real or true, that they are subjective, and that if we had grown up in a big, vibrant Mexican family in the ghetto, hearing constantly that loyalty is the greatest value and that defending your family is the right thing to do, then you might have done the exact same thing. It's important to note that while right view, remember I said before, right view unfolds into the rest of the Eightfold Path, but so does wrong view. So wrong view is going to unfold into wrong thought, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihoods, et cetera, et cetera. And so really investigating for ourselves what is unfolding? What is unfolding from our fundamental views? People aren't trying to go out and consciously cause pain to themselves and others, and either are you, I think. It's all about view. What is the impact, for example, of a person who believes that Jews are a lesser species, that are destroying a country he loves and an economy he believes he can fix for the betterment of all true Germans? It's likely that Hitler believed he was doing the just thing. He was returning his beloved country into the pure state that he deeply believed it should be in. His actions were the root cause of the problem. His actions were not the root cause of the problem. It was his view. And that view was formed through his years of living on the streets of Vienna, homeless, while suffering from the grief of losing his beloved mother, with unresolved trauma from an abusive father. The reason I first wrote this talk is that on the month long at Spirit Rock, my favorite teacher gave a talk on Wise View. And he shared in that talk a story that inspired me to create my own. And this, I'm getting emotional. This was a deeply moving story. It's one of those stories, you know, when you hear something and it just changes your life. This was one of those moments for me. This really changed my life. So he was sharing, he had this journal of a colonel that lived in North America during the time where the English took over and were just basically killing the Native Americans. But this colonel was quite a nice colonel, obviously, he was keeping a journal, yeah. And he had built a good relationship, which was quite unusual. He had built a good relationship with the Native tribes around him. And one of the chief of those tribes, his daughter died. And the chief came to see the colonel to basically request like a proper ceremonial burial. And the colonel agreed. And when the colonel agreed, the chief cried. And in the journal entry, the colonel wrote a line that Oren read out to other teacher, read out to us. And it was, "I didn't know that an Indian could cry." So what kind of atrocities are possible when you don't even see a species of people as even? He didn't even think a Native American could experience the same emotions that a white person could. So, of course, the actions of going in and taking over these people that they're not even seeing as people are inherently justified in their mind. And it might be a stretch, but can we even call them atrocities if the view, you know, if they're not even understanding what they're doing, to them, it's not an atrocity. Only when we see from a broader perspective that the view is incorrect, can we go on to call it that? Can we look back in retrospect at our own actions or the actions of others? The view that the Indians are savages, not containing the breadth and depth of emotion, love, intelligence, tears. So what are we viewing in the world right now that allows us to consider atrocities that we're not thinking of as being atrocities? How do we view animals? Do we view them as sentient beings whose, you know, emotion, when you look at the brain, emotion came out of the mammalian brain, not the prefrontal cortex, not the human prefrontal cortex. So why are we assuming, or do we assume, that the animals are not feeling isolation or separation or despair as we farm them, put them in pens, separate them, eat them, you know? How do we view the earth? Do we view the earth as a sentient being? Do we view the earth as being an extension of our body. I mean, this, we can't exist without this earth. How are we viewing it? How do people view it that allow them to just take what they want, to dam up the rivers, to put up, clear another forest? No one, these people that are doing this, they're not thinking it's atrocious because the view is incorrect. And what unchallenged views do we hold that prevent us from connecting deeply to our loved ones, our friends, our co-workers? Are we more willing to hold on to a view than we are to connect? And if a view we're holding is preventing us from connecting, the view needs to be explored and examined. What views are we holding that cloud our sense of joy or happiness or ease or safety? For example, if we look only at death, loss, decay, and the ending of things, how will we see the world? And it is true. Things are constantly dying, constantly ending, constantly decaying. That is true. But it is not the only thing that's true. Its opposite is also equally true. Things are also always living, birthing, growing, expanding, right? So what view are we taking and how is it affecting us, and is it balanced or unbalanced? When we understand deeply that our thoughts, speech, and actions spring from view, then we can look deeply at our lives and ask, like, is this thought, action, speech leading to suffering for ourselves or for others? And then we can go back, we can kind of reverse engineer, and we can look, what's the view that these thoughts and actions and speech are coming out of? What's the view? Have a look. And then we can ask, how can this view be altered compared with another view that could be equally as true or completely let go of? End that suffering for ourselves and for others. And this process requires us to understand that views are malleable, that they are not inherently real, that they are dependent on conditions, and that they can be let go of or changed. You can let go of a view. Like, we get that with the little views, but sometimes we don't get that with the big ones, yeah? The ones that are most important to us. So we'll come back now and have a look at the traditional view, yeah? So the Buddha most often taught that right view is seeing clearly into the Four Noble Truths. To really see them, to really understand them. That's wise view. That's the view that's going to take you where you want to go, is to see the Four Noble Truths. So this means seeing and understanding and acknowledging that there is dukkha, there is suffering. And I'm talking about, like, the line at the grocery store is long, right? To not just say, oh, I shouldn't be angry now, but to really acknowledge, oh, I'm irritated, I'm impatient, this is suffering. To not shy away, to not just be like, I shouldn't think that, so I'm just going to put it over here and pretend it's not happening. Or, as often happens in a lot of the yoga circles I'm involved in, is you know, that real kind of toxic positivity, or the turning away from what is hard, or cutting low vibe people out of your life so that you can, you know, stay happy and positive. You know, that is not going to lead to happiness in the short term. you know, or people that deny illness or injury, you know. And then when something, there's a lot of people who will try to avoid until it becomes unavoidable through some big life thing, a cancer diagnosis, a loss of a loved one. And then it is just so challenging at that point because that person has not practiced being with suffering. So really, wise view is turning toward it with courage, compassion. This is suffering. I see it. It's here. This is the truth of this moment right now. This moment, suffering. And not just saying that, but feeling it in your bones, feeling it, getting down into the mind state, noticing what's here, getting really curious, bringing your mindfulness and your concentration to this process, because that's what makes the second noble truth possible. Because you're not turning away from the suffering, because you have curiosity, you can investigate what is the cause of the suffering? What's happening here? Am I being a self-obsessed beaver? Right? Yeah. Wise view is really understanding the cause. Wise view is knowing this is what is happening now. I'm clinging to something. And in the context of this thought, it may be that you're clinging to a view. You know, check it out. Wise view is really getting this process. I understand. And you can only do that if you turn toward the suffering. And right view is also seeing the third noble truth, that sometimes the suffering stops. Yeah. And wise view would kind of be able to go in there and see that and notice the causes of why it stopped. What happened here? Was I able to drop a view? Did my understanding of the world open out and I'm seeing more of that river of life? I'm seeing into the conditionality of things, that I'm not inherently bad or wrong, but the conditions of my life have led to some unskillful behavior. And the opening of that view has led to a softening. Or we bring some compassion into a difficulty and it softens. And we notice, here's the cessation of suffering for this moment. Wise view is understanding what caused that cessation. Right view is knowing and appreciating those small everyday moments of awakening when we're just present to an object and it's present to us. And we're just with that river of life and our self-obsession drops a little bit. Right view is understanding the fourth noble truth too. I think this is pretty magic. The fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. Yeah. So here's another example of how the teachings fold back on themselves. If we understand the Four Noble Truths deeply, then we understand that the Eightfold Path is a way to then come back and understand the Noble Truths more fully, right? And around it goes. So using wise view to... using the Eightfold Path can help you to refine your view, yeah? So this is quite practical. When we are suffering, we have a really good opportunity. We can look into our grief, our stress, our impatience at the grocery line or those big, deep existential things. We can look what is really happening here and we can use the Eightfold Path to do that, right? We can investigate what areas of the Eightfold Path have either contributed to this suffering, like was there a lapse in mindfulness? Was there some unwise speech? So we can use the Eightfold Path to kind of have a look what was happening here. And then we can also use the Eightfold Path to figure out how can I lessen this suffering? Is there some more concentration or stability of mind that needs to be cultivated? Is there some mindfulness required here to have a look at what's happening? Can I use some wise speech and go and apologize to my dear friend? You know, is there, in the context of this talk, a view that needs refining? with investigation, with kind of this deep investigation, with this real close looking, we can see the changeability of our beliefs and views. And if you can't quite see that yet, you could contemplate that all it takes to change a view is one piece of new information. Have you ever had that experience? Like you really believed something and then you got a new piece of information and you're like, oh, okay, it's like this now. Yeah. So you can always ask yourself, what piece of information have I currently not got that could change this view? What would change the way of looking? When we realize that views are dependent on information, right? They're just dependent on new bits of information, and that new information could come at any time, you could see that it's not wise to put your faith or your trust or your sense of self into a view. It is, in fact, proof that we should examine every single view that causes trouble, everyone, using the Eightfold Path as a support. If a view does not lead to the helpful qualities of love, kindness, compassion, joy, forgiveness, connection, tolerance, openness, it is more than likely worth changing. If we look around the world, we can see how much trouble we're in because of fixed views. A lot of trouble. Not just Anzac Day where there was a war, we have a war right now. Men going off to fight a war, they probably don't even want to fight for one man's views, one man's fixed views about how things should be. Conflict is only possible because of fixed views. In my guiding light are the words of Thich Nhat Hanh. I love this. I love these words. Relatively speaking, there are right views and wrong views. But if we look more deeply, we see that all views are wrong views. No view can ever be the truth. It is just from one point. That is why it's called a point of view. If we go to another point, we will see things differently and realize that our first view was not entirely right. Buddhism is not a collection of views. It's a practice to help us eliminate wrong views. The quality of our views can always be improved. I love that. From the viewpoint of ultimate reality, right view is the absence of all views. So, you might have gotten the idea that views are bad and you shouldn't have them, but I'm here to tell you there is absolutely no problem with having a view. No problem with having a view. Of course you have views. You have to have views. You have to believe things and have truths and understand where you fit. We all need views to survive. We actually need them to survive, to know our place. Yeah, so no problem. The problem is being rigid with your views. Holding on to the views until suffering overtakes us. The real art with views is to be malleable, to be flexible, to be willing to give, to know when to hold on and when to let them go. I once had a view that I took to Alan. And this is a deep view of mine from having been a paramedic. And that view was that people shouldn't be violent. Seems like a pretty fair view. You could even say that's true. People shouldn't be violent. But that view was causing me a lot of suffering. Why? Because people are violent. That's how it is. And there are times where that view is really helpful because it propels me to go and give these talks or to be a Dharma teacher. So at times, this is a beautiful view to be cherished and to be used as fuel. And at other times, it is a view that causes suffering if it is held onto too tight, because I'm just fighting with reality. That's what I mean about being malleable, being flexible, knowing when to pick it up, when to put it down. We need to know how to be flowing like a great river to the sea. When we are flexible, we start to be able to hold the views of others right next to our own. We can see that they are both true and fair, that they can both coexist, that we can be connected despite our views, or even because of them. Our self-obsession opens up to include other people's truth. We all can have our truth together. And this is the end of war, the end of conflict, the end of loneliness. This is where the title comes from. The monkey is reaching for the moon in the water. Until death overtakes him, he'll never give up. If he'd just let go the branch and disappear in the deep pool, the whole world would shine with dazzling pureness. We are like the monkey, holding on to our views. The moon the monkey is reaching for is just an illusion. It's not inherently real, but he doesn't know that. So he keeps holding on. Do you want to be like the monkey? Holding tight to this illusion of rightness? Or can you see that the view can be let go of, compared to an equally true view, changed, just dropped? All we have to do is let go, to drop into the deep pool of oneness where views no longer matter. As Rumi says, beyond views of right and wrong, there is a field, and I'll meet you there. And at first it can feel frightening to hold our views lightly, because we might feel that we don't have a ground. We lose our place. Like, what do I stand for? And often people don't like it. They want you to have an opinion. But we can realize as we continue to practice that the place we stand on is the very spaciousness that our flexibility allows, that malleability opens us out, and we can rest our sense of self in there, our sense of ground in there. We rest in the river, the flow of life, as the Buddha says, not clinging to anything in the world. So I'll leave you with the wise words of John Lennon. The more I see, the less I know for sure. Let's just sit together for a couple minutes.
Thank you so much for your kind attention and your deep listening. We'll have a 10-ish minute